All right, Cam is in New England. Cam is a member of the Patriots. Cam is going to play for Bill Belichick. And Key, we talked about it earlier, Patriots are going to be the team to beat in the AFC East. The question is, how much better beyond that are they? Are they one of the best teams in the AFC? Are they one of the best teams in the NFL? Because as far as late acquisitions go at the most important position on the field, getting Cam Newton basically for free, I mean, we're talking NFL money, $7 million for your quarterback is basically for free. You couldn't ask for much more than that. It's just an incredible acquisition by the Patriots and a great landing spot for Cam to go play for Bill Belichick in that system with those opportunities.
Yeah, and it's not so much about the money as much as it is about rejuvenating what people perceived as a down, you know, sort of kind of like a down 2 or 3 year period for Cam Newton. And why not do it with a guy like Bill Belichick and Josh McDaniels, who have been one of the, you know, more innovative offensive minds and coordinators in the NFL for, you know, a period of time. Belichick is not only a defensive minded guy, he's a football coach. He knows offense. Mm-hmm. And he understands what offense is, and he understands what a guy like Cam Newton can do. If you go back, this isn't, you know, this is not, people would say, your typical Bill Belichick quarterback, right? You would think that, correct?
Sure.
That's not true, though. Because if you go back, Bill Belichick has not only had a number of quarterbacks with this sort of type of style in the years that he's been a coach. He drafted a guy named Michael Bishop out of Kansas State. He had a Jacoby Brissett before, along with a couple other guys that he had on the roster around. So people just automatically assume, well, this is so much different. Well, no, because he does things with what he has. What he, you know, two tight end sets, he basically innovated that with Gronkowski and Hernandez. And all of a sudden, everybody else started trying to do the two tight end deal all the time. He took the Wayne Corbett slot receiver deal to a whole nother level. Well, now everybody else is trying to duplicate that. So it's not out of question that he would take a guy like Cam Newton and put him in a system that everybody's seen for 20 years run by a guy who was essentially a statue and now going to change a little bit to get the best out of an MVP from 2015 in Cam Newton. So I'm looking forward to it.
I do question the construction of the roster, which, as far as I can tell, hasn't really changed. And so when you look at the criticism of the New England's offense a season ago and the struggles statistically anyway of Tom Brady, the fact that he didn't have any weapons, he didn't have anybody to throw it to, that hasn't changed. That mm-hmm. still is in place. So
But what I would say,
I understand
you, LZ,
being excited about what Cam can
but
do.
Well, let me explain yeah. something to you, though, real quick, LZ. A lot of times, what happens with coaches is they do things, and I think I've said this before with other positions, is they do things based on the strength of what they feel they have at that position, right? They felt the strength of their position was the quarterback. So they used Brady and rode Brady in his arm. When you replace Brady, now, all of a sudden, you get an opportunity to see other things that you don't have to rely on Brady to do everything. You can now rely on a Cam Newton's legs. You can rely on his arm. You think N'Keal Harry, a young receiver, you may have tried to put him in positions that Brady did things well at throwing the football. May not have been his strength. So now, all of a sudden, his strength is the vertical stretch game, which Cam Newton does well. The back shoulder game, which Cam Newton does well. So that's how coaches do things. When you look at players, they say, well, he only can play in this position. True, unless you put him in another position and see if he can do it. And that's what you're seeing. You're going to see with a Cam Newton. The offense is not going to look the same. They're not going to. This is why I say to you, this might be a Wes Welker kind of descending statistically, or not as many touches statistically, but more productive in the offense because of what Cam Newton's able to do.
Let me throw this out there, because I literally, as we're talking about this, I got my TV on and they're showing a highlight rip of Cam Newton, and it's spectacular. What jumps out at you is that the different things that you were just talking about, Keith, that he can make throws, he can run, he's big, he's strong, all of these things. But the other thing that's right behind that as you're watching this, that dude is getting the absolute stuffing knocked out of him. He is just taking shot after shot after shot. And I know that he just turned 31 years old. I know that as far as birth certificate goes, he's not an old quarterback. But as far as hits go, he's taken more than his fair share. Is there at least – I know, Key, that you don't believe this, that you just think it's a matter of him getting healthy, but there at least has to be in the back of your mind, if you're Bill Belichick, the idea that he's just shot, that he just went through what he went through, got beat up so badly for so long that now that guy that we remember from the MVP season back in 2015, the guy that was pretty good the year after that is just – ancient history, that the guy that you're getting now is the guy that we've seen the last 2 years who has either been incapable of playing because he's been hurt, or when he has played, has not played particularly well because he's been hurt.
LZ and Travis, there's a difference between being beat up and being injury prone. He was beat up. He's not injury prone. And so there's a huge difference in that. And when
why do you say he's not injury prone?
Because he's not like hurt, comes back, hurt again, hurt something else again, comes back for 2 days.
But
oh, now his finger hurts.
And foot in the last two seasons showed two different injuries. It's
two different injuries, right? You know, 2 different years. That's not injury prone. Injury prone is when a guy is back with you for 5 weeks, then he's hurt again, he's on the shelf for 3. And he's back with you for a year, then the next year he's hurt for 4 games, comes back for 6. That's injury prone. This happens to be an injury
that
they didn't manage.
Isn't that what he's been
the last 2 years? No. There was an injury that they didn't manage. It was an injury that they didn't manage correctly and came back too early and re-injured it. That's a big difference from injury prone.
Well, can you still be injury prone and yet available? Like, just because you're injured,
no, because if you're injury, if you're injury prone, you're gonna not be available too many games, so you're not worth it. You cannot help the club in the tub, which is the hot tub or the tub, the cold tub, and that sort of thing.
That's where Cam been.
You can't help your team that way. Bill Belichick, as well as Josh McDaniels and the New England Patriots, clearly understand the injury was a season-ending injury versus I'm in, I'm out, I'm in, I'm out, I'm in, I'm out. That's what you don't want to be dealing with. You don't want to deal with a quarterback in and out every other day. You want to deal with a guy that may have had an injury at the beginning of the season, tried to come back from it, it didn't work, now he's fully healthy again. That's what you want to deal with. Because his body... Travis, to speak to being beat up all the time, his body can absorb them hits. His body, his foot
for a while.
His foot,
for a while.
His foot didn't crack or break or whatever it was because he got hit.
Breaking
that's
news,
not,
guys.
That's
breaking
not what
news.
Happened.
Breaking news. Here we go. Here we go. Am I gonna get the music?
Dun dun dun. Dun, dun, dun. I got you.
Jesus, that sounds terrible. Mark Stein just tweeted. The Lakers, league sources say, are expected to finalize a rest of the season contract with J.R. Smith before Tuesday's 11:59 p.m. Eastern Time closure of the NBA's transaction window. Rosters for the NBA restarted Walt Disney World must be turned into the league office Wednesday. So it looks as if J.R. Smith, at least according to longtime NBA reporter Mark Stein, will be a Laker. He is expected to sign before tomorrow's deadline.
You surprised at that one? I'm not, especially after Avery Bradley decided that he was going to stick with his family.
Well, it's not about surprise as much as the conversation we've been having all day, which is, can you trust him? The Lakers are saying, yes, we can. And I never questioned what he brought to the basketball court.
Oh, can you can you trust him to leave and stay? Oh, man, come on.
All
LZ,
the
don't,
above.
Don't do him like that.
No, it's not an unfair question.
No, I know, but don't do him like that, though.
Do him like what?
I don't think he would do that.
He threw soup at his coach.
But wait,
he threw soup at his coach, man.
Yeah,
come on, dog.
But that's different. That's him and the coach. I'm talking about the league, the entire league.
Keith, this is the conversation we've been having, though. I hear what you're saying, that you wouldn't do it because you don't want to put the league at risk. But if you
and
have
all
people,
your teammates and friends,
think of how many times other players have put their teammates and other people in harm's way. Think about all the time, just human beings, right? I saw somebody make this comparison the other day about how what you're basically asking everybody, and again, it's not just the players, it's staffers, it's coaches, it's everybody that's going to be inside of this bubble. You're basically asking everybody to be safe on behalf of everyone else. Well, how many people drink and drive every single day? All over the place. It's not just bad for the person that's doing it. It's bad for the rest of us because you might hit us. But people do it all the time. We know it's bad for you. We know it's dangerous. We know you can be penalized and lose your license and go to jail. We know that you might end up killing somebody. People still do it because they say, oh, man, nothing's going to happen to me. I'm only going a few blocks. And instead of that, it's going to be, I'm just going to get a drink. I'm just going to meet her for a few hours. I'm just going to do this or to do that. People do it all the time, even with incredible risk involved in activities. That's going to be just like this.
Well, if he do that, then he's just stupid.
No, he's just human. That just makes him human.
Not if they're telling me, if they're telling me that this is the consequences of potentially what could happen, you just can't do it. You just can't do it. I'm not going.
Look outside your window. We told people what can happen, and yet you see the response of Americans.
I understand. Now, I understand, LZ. We're talking about Americans, individuals. I get it. But we're talking about an isolated bubble, and they're telling you, don't your ass go outside them ropes.
Yeah, but it's the bubble is filled with human beings. The bubble is not filled with people that are from another
planet. If you
got to
go have a drink at the other hotel bar in the bubble, because there's going to be a number of hotels.
I want more than just the drink. I want more than just the drink. All right. J.R. Smith is going to be a member of the Lakers. That, according to Mark Stein, which LZ just told us right there, their opening night game against the Clippers. How important is it a tone setter? That's next on the morning show on 710 ESPN. Dove Key, today, June 29th, 1990, is the anniversary of Fernando Valenzuela's no-hitter as a member of the Dodgers. That was 30 years ago. I remember watching that on TV last night. It was the same day that Dave Stewart had thrown a no-hitter earlier that night.
Yeah, Stu threw one, and then Fernando with the screwball coming off the mound, number 34, mm-hmm. came in and just sliced it. That wasn't even at home, though, huh?
It was at home. It was at home. Yeah, against the Cardinals. And Pedro, I don't know why I remember this, but Pedro Guerrero made the last out of the game, grounded the ball back up the middle, and they threw him out of first base. It was – you forget. I know you know, Key, and I know that there's been a 30-for-30 on it.
Where was Pedro at?
He was with the Cardinals at that point.
Okay, yeah, he moved to the Cardinals. Yeah, okay, that's right.
Yeah, but Fernando Mania, and 1990 was well past Fernando Mania. I mean, that was almost
Mania
a decade.
Was 88 or something like that.
81.
81,
It was 81, but Fernando still holds a really special part. I mean, Fernando Valenzuela is not one of the greatest pitchers in Dodger history, but he's one of the most important, he's one of the most compelling, and certainly one of the most memorable guys to have ever put on that uniform.
But if you didn't say he wasn't one of the greatest pitchers, I wouldn't even – because of everything else around him, it just feels like
exactly.
He was one of those dudes that he was one of them 16, 15 strikeout guys. You know, hanging the K's at the top of the bleachers. You know, was like, if you didn't tell me that, because he didn't have a long career at dominance, he had like a short window where he was just like the guy.
He was really good through the 80s. He showed up in 81. He won the Cy Young Award. He won the Rookie of the Year Award. And then he was on the All-Star team, I want to say, probably six times through the 80s. He was really good. But he was never Clayton Kershaw. He was never Sandy Koufax. He was never one of those guys. But he was just so unbelievably charismatic, so unbelievably interesting, that your memory is a little different than his actual performance. Because he ended up pitching forever.
What was his career batting average?
He could swing it.
I know. What you think he was about? 200?
I bet you it's like 240. And I'm going to look right now, but I bet you it's high, especially for a pitcher.
But the thing is, though, I understand that statistically, especially as you pointed out, Travis, after like 87, 88 or whatever, he wasn't the same guy when he first came into the scene. I would like to see the Hall of Famers consider everything. Because if you consider everything, what he did for the sport was phenomenal. It was like absolutely transformative. And just like they found a way to recognize in the NBA or at least the International Basketball Hall of Fame, they found a way to reward Yao Ming, recognizing both on and off the court what he did and why that makes him a Hall of Famer. I don't see why you wouldn't do the same for Fernando.
No, under those criteria, he absolutely 100% is a dead cinch Hall of Famer. Key, you hit it exactly right. Fernando Valenzuela's lifetime batting average is 200.
Dang.
Exactly right.
I didn't look it up, as you know, but it felt 200-ish.
Yeah.
But he was good. I mean, look, if there was a time where you got up.
No, he was great.
It was a time when you got up, and let's say, for instance, he got up to bat, and it was, you know, Dodgers down by two, but they may want to pull him or elect to let him bat because there's a few guys on base. You go, man, let him bat. He cool. We good. He was better than the pinch hitters.
He won the Silver Slugger twice. And that's so for people that might not know, the Silver Slugger is you are the best hitter at your position in the whole league. And he won that twice. So he was the best hitting pitcher.
I remember he went yard when I was like, damn.
Well, whenever you get into those extra inning games, too, where you get into the 14th, 15th inning, Fernando would play first base and get three or four at bats. I mean, that's just how he would go. He was an incredible player.
How about this for a stat? 1990. 29 years old. Do you know what he was batting? This is crazy.
250.
Over 300.
No, just you know, he's still around.
What did he have? About five home runs that year?
Let's see.
Let's see here. That year he had one home run, 11 ribbies.
He hit 10 home runs in his career, though, Key.
I remember the first time I seen him hit a jack. I was like, damn. He ain't supposed to do that. He's supposed to just swing at three pitches and go on back to the dugout.
Not him. He could absolutely smash it. All right. Lakers and the Clippers, they're going to play on opening night of the NBA rebooting the season. We know that they've played three times. Clippers got him the first couple of times. Then the Lakers, behind a very hot fourth quarter from Avery Bradley, beat the Clippers in the most recent meeting right before we went into quarantine. They're going to restart the season together. Does the result of that game matter? Because to me, it feels a whole bunch like an exhibition game, like a preseason game. More of a, all right, let's get a sweat going. Let's play somebody else. Instead of doing a scrimmage or an inter squad, we're going to have another opponent. But the final score really doesn't feel all that meaningful to me, because these eight games before the playoffs, this is your preseason before the sprint of the playoffs start about 2 weeks after that.
Well, I think you want to have a strong showing. You'd like to certainly win. But I think that the Lakers have already shown the Clippers they can win, and vice versa. And it's not a seven-game stretch, right? These are, I play you in October, I'll see you again in December. I'll see you in January, oh, we'll play again in April. So it's all spread all over the place. And I think you want to just get back out there and show, remember the last time I saw you, this is what happened. And that's pretty much it. Whether at the end of it, your score is more than theirs, it really doesn't matter. But from a, you know, I would call it a three-quarter standpoint, you want to push it up and down the floor.
You know, I tend to just find that this matchup to be important for the psyche aspect of it. You want to come out the gate, if you're the Lakers, find the best team in your Western Conference and pop them in the mouth right out the gate, sending a message saying, we're still that squad. And I feel as if, given the fact that they lost the first two games and people started to question LeBron when they lost those games, it feels as if the Clippers come out right out the gate and pop them in the mouth, it just sends a different message. And so I understand what you're saying, Key, and I recognize the layoff and, you know, its impact it can have on rhythm. But everyone had the same layoff. Everyone had the same timeout. No one gets extra credit because they're coming back from a pandemic. You're all starting off in the same plane. And when it comes to ball and it comes to looking across and wondering if you really can beat that dude, and I'm not talking about Bron, and I'm not talking about AD. I'm talking about everybody else you need to be, you know, together in order to beat someone. Remember, when those Cavs and Golden State Warrior finals we were having, Draymond Green was snatching Cavalier hearts left and right, starting with Kevin Love. Snatching hearts. Won the mental game before the ball was even in the air. That same dynamic can happen in this rivalry with some of the other players. Not the top guys, but some of the smaller guys. Pat Beverly starts yapping in your ear, man, you ain't doing nothing. What are you talking about? Blah, 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 blah. And start yapping at you. That's what I'm talking about. That aspect of it. That's what they need. That's what they're fighting against.
I get that. I just think that the Lakers are going to have other needs that precede having to go in and attack the Clippers like it's Game 7 of the Western Conference Finals. That it's going to be more of a, hey, let's see what we got from JR. Let's see what we got with Deion. Does Deion work better in this situation or that situation? Does JR pair better with this guy or that guy? What is our fitness level for this guy or that guy? And it's more of an evaluation. Had this game been played deeper into these eight games, you know, every team's going to play eight games coming back into the bubble. If this were game 6, 7, or 8, then I think it would mean a little bit more to me, because then you've kind of got your legs back underneath you. You've kind of figured out how you're going to use some of these additional pieces. Like you mentioned, LZ, that Joakim Noah is going to be back with the Clippers. They got to figure out how they're going to use him, if at all. But once I've got the roster questions ironed out a little bit, then I can worry more about the final push. But I just, especially in that first game, this is a let's throw it out there and see where we are. This is an evaluation much more than a contest to me.
Well, it is an
evaluation, Travis. That's why I said you go out there and you evaluate yourself for about three quarters up against them. And that's kind of how you do things. You don't. If you lose, it's like, okay, I lost. But you show for three quarters that, okay, this is who we are, and if we did it for four, we would do the exact same thing to you.
I like the Serena method. Serena may not be playing well in the tournament. She may not be playing well for the stretch of the year. But every time she saw Maria Sharapova, she whooped that ass and let her know, not you. So I want the Lakers to act like Serena, and I want them to make the Clippers Maria Sharapova and be like, we may be experimenting. We may be trying to find things out. But you ain't getting this W.
All right. Tom Brady and Russell Wilson are working out with some of their teammates, and the union does not like it. We'll explain next on the morning show on 710 ESPN. Well, they should have one more than they do, because they had to give one back because they got caught cheating.
They'll trade a kicker that used to be there and get that third round pick back. Watch.
Is it just the culture of their deal that just no matter what it is, let's just keep cheating, just keep pushing the envelope. If we get caught, we get caught. We'll pay the fine. We'll sacrifice a draft pick, because this clearly is a systemic problem inside of that organization. This is not just something with one guy had a camera trained on the sidelines. This is a repeat pattern that the Patriots have going back the better part of 15 years.
I'm not really authorized to speak on the New England Patriots habits of whatever you want to call it. It's hard for me to say, man. I try to give everybody the benefit of the doubt with things. And I just – it's like you're doing it in the face of everybody as if nobody cares or nobody sees what you're doing. Is it such that we, the people on the outside, jump to some major conclusions about things that they do? Or is it really them really doing these things? You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
It's a combination of both. But the thing that really, to me anyway, that really highlights how nefarious and good they are at being nefarious is that when they get caught, they're really good at changing the conversation very, very quickly. I mean, the Cam Newton signing being announced the same day that we find out Robert Kraft massage parlor therapy, whatever you want to call it, trial is back in the headlines, and they get busted for the cheating. But think about, like, just a couple of months ago, right? What was that, like less than a year ago? Think about Julian Edelman. On the cars out there vandalizing. But before we can get our teeth in that story, good. There now it's news that he played hurt, and they immediately forced the conversation to change to talk about Julian Edelman play with what was a cracked rib or a hurt rib or something like that. They're so good at, even when they get caught, trying to convince you, Keyshawn Johnson, to pay attention to something else.
Well, think about it. To Key's point about there being a variety of, you want to give them the benefit of the doubt, Spygate, Deflategate, Videogate. These are all things we know happened. These are not, maybe this, maybe that. This is three things that they've been caught for and punished for or investigated for. And this isn't just because I agree with you. Sometimes like, maybe it is, maybe it's not. I don't know. The second time it's, all right, you know, maybe it is, maybe it's not, but I got my eye on you. By the time we get to the third one, you just cheat, man.
Yeah, I mean, I guess. I don't know.
You guess?
It's hard for me. It's hard for me to even say why they did, you know, doing the things that they do, because it takes away from the credit that you want to give to the organization and you want to give to Bill as a hell of a head coach. It really does. You know, I can't sit here and say that, you know, it's just, I can't sit here and say that I've ever seen or been around Belichick and Parcells and a whole crew and felt like we was ever doing anything wrong. I can honestly say that because I played for them when we were together at the Jets. Now, you would say, well, what if they didn't do it with the Jets? No. You just don't learn that overnight. If you've been doing it, you've been doing it for a long time, you would think, right?
You would think.
So, I don't know. Well, maybe he learned it after he left the Jets.
And he didn't do it
in Cleveland. That's why they wasn't ultra successful.
Maybe. Or he became more sophisticated at it. Here's another option. Just because you didn't know about it doesn't mean it wasn't happening.
Oh, well, there is that.
Yeah. Because I'm not saying that every single person that's on the Patriots is fully aware of the schemes and shenanigans that they have going on. In fact, it's probably a very small group of people that are actually in the know on what's going on. It's just, you can't get caught that many times and have it just be everybody is doing it, because if everybody was doing it, then everybody else would be getting caught roughly the same amount of times. This comes up to them frequently, and it's always kind of the same thing. It's espionage, right? It's the going back to the Super Bowl when they beat the Rams the first time. Was that 2001? Going back to that year, going back to the Eric Mangini situation where he said, you know, you're not better not do that against us. I know how you guys roll. It's taking the air out of the football. It's recording the video, the guy on the side of the Bengals and getting caught. Key, you couldn't sound more guilty up to no good.
No, he really,
than that guy
he really,
did.
He really did, but did he? Look, they obviously did something. Right? Because they wouldn't have got fined. They wouldn't have got everything happened. But did he do it, was told to do it by Belichick and them, or was he doing it trying to impress them? Like, what's behind it?
So you want to know if he did it on his own or was he
directed? Trying to show them, look, I can do this.
That works for the first one, Key. That might even work for the second one with Deflategate. Like, I deferred the balls, but I just wanted to make sure that Tom was happy because I know, you know, the pressure that he likes to ball at when he throws. And I didn't ask him for permission. He didn't tell me to do it. I just did it to try and get in good with him. You can even do it with those two. But after a while, to Travis's point, like, everybody's not out trying to do things to impress you unless you set a tone within your culture that says that is the unwritten expectation.
But I can delete this right here for you.
And here's the other part, too. If you do have, let's say the Patriots were innocent, right? There are a couple of things that just look bad, but there are explanations that make them, that are mitigating factors. Say, okay, the idea of some rogue video guy just going off on his own after a cloud of suspicion has been over that organization for a while and saying, oh, hey, look, I'm going to do this and I'll show Bill Belichick. He'll think I'm great and he'll put me on. I mean, there's no low-level video guy that's just going to freelance that on their own without explicit instruction from somebody that matters in that world.
I mean, you would think, and as much as, you know, we think that it's a big deal in the conversation, it's my sense anyway, that for a lot of fans, despite all the allegations and the gray cloud that hangs over the organization, that it ultimately doesn't matter. That unless, you know, you found, you know, Brady taking a PED or something scientifically proven, anything that even can be injected with a little bit of subjectivity, they're going to grab hold of that because no one wants this franchise to be a cheater. We all want to recognize this franchise as being amazing and able to do things no one else could do and do all those things the right way. And if it gets undermined by the concept of cheating or the visual of cheating, it just leaves a really bad taste in your mouth. So unless, again, this is just my sense, not in terms of people inside of NFL, but outside of the NFL, unless there is something irrefutable, I just don't see none of these little cheating scandals really ultimately sticking to their legacy.
George Sedano coming up next. Crosstalk straight ahead on the morning show on 710 ESPN. All right, George will join us here in a second. You know, I was just looking at Fernando's baseball reference page again. LZ, you need to start a position, and I want to be the first signature. Fernando Valenzuela should be in the Hall of Fame because he had a little six-year window where he was extraordinary, and everything that comes along with it should be more than enough to put him over the top.
And him not being – at least having a statue is not recognizing what his impact was to the Dodgers organization and the game away from the diamond. And that, to me, is my point. When it's like if you add in the Yao Ming factor and you can actually ask yourself – what did you do for the game? It isn't just a statistical question or even a championship question. To me, it's an all-encompassing question. If you do it that way, there's no reason why he shouldn't have a statue or no reason why he shouldn't be in the Hall of Fame.
What do you think, George? Fernando Valenzuela, Hall of Famer, yes or no?
Yes, for the reasons LZ outlined, at least specifically, the Dodgers should do more to make – mention of how important he was and impactful he was here. Look, the history of the Dodgers and the Mexican community prior to Fernando Valenzuela wasn't always great, right? Like, they took people's homes to build that particular stadium there. And I think that that went a long way to changing some of the dynamics of the Mexican community and the Dodgers specifically. So the Baseball Hall of Fame, I'd be okay with it from a Yao Ming perspective, but I do think even the Dodgers could do more with Fernando.
All right, George. So we found out that the Lakers and the Clippers, they're going to play that first night of the NBA restarting their season. We've been going around and around. How meaningful is that? Is that a glorified exhibition for these two teams, or is there some meaning in it beyond that?
No, it's a glorified exhibition. That's pretty much what it is. I don't think that – look, I wouldn't play anybody more than 30 minutes if I were either side at this point, at least not for that first game. Like, what's the whole point of that? I think teams like the Lakers and look, maybe the Clippers eventually turn it up a little bit because I don't think any of this matters, but even if they're the third seed, like who cares? They still wouldn't play the Lakers until the conference finals. So I just don't know how much incentive there is to actually play meaningful minutes.
Well, my argument, George, was that if it was any other team, I would agree. But because it's the Clippers and they've gotten you a couple of times, you don't want your younger players or your unproven players to have that hanging over their heads mentally. Three losses to this one squad, because a guy like a Patrick Beverley or even Morris, they can get in your ear and start chirping about that. And because of those three losses, you have some doubt in your mind.
I don't know if I buy that, LZ. I mean, maybe it's just because it's a LeBron James-led team. And if, you know, look, over the years, there have been plenty of teams that have had his number during the regular season, and it hasn't mattered all that much in the postseason. You know what I'm saying? Like Paul Pierce and the Celtics, the Bulls, the Nets with Paul Pierce and Kevin Garnett again. You know what I'm saying? Like, there have been, even in Cleveland, right? Like, there were some teams. Boston had kind of their number a little bit, and now they pushed them to seven the year Kyrie left, but they still won. So I just don't put a lot of stock in that stuff.
All right, so Cam Newton finally found a team, George. He's going to go to New England. He's going to play for Bill Belichick. Are they one of the teams to beat coming into the season? We know that Patrick Mahomes and Lamar Jackson are probably the top two teams, Kansas City and Baltimore, in the AFC. But do you put New England right behind them with Cam?
No. I think they're going to win the AFC East. I think they're a playoff team, but I don't know, man. Like, I'd like to see a healthy Cam Newton first before I make that determination. But today, I don't know if it's a healthy Cam Newton that we're dealing with. But I do think they're winning the AFC East. I do think they're going to be in the playoffs. And once you're in that, I mean, things can happen. I just don't think they're as good as Kansas City. I don't even think they're as good as Baltimore.
George, just switching gears just for a second. Do you think it's a coincidence that the day that Robert Kraft's trial hits the newsroom again, and the day that the New England Patriots are fined for cheating, that Cam Newton signing also is news that came out today? Is that a coincidence?
Yeah, I mean, probably not. You know what I'm saying? Like, you could have picked a million different days to have signed Cam Newton. But, you know, because I know that North Turner spoke to them, spoke to Bill Belichick, you know, weeks ago, maybe longer. You know what I'm saying? So, I don't know. I'm sure it probably has something to do with that, like the timing of it. They might have signed Cam anyway, but today, making sure it was out today probably was a plan.
And then there's the whole, you know, they had a draft pick taken away. They're fined $1 million, that part of it, too. Is this just how they roll, George, that they just go ahead and they're looking for every possible advantage? And if you catch us every once in a while, we'll pay the penalty. We'll sacrifice the draft pick. That this is just how the Patriots roll. We will try to push the envelope at every given opportunity.
Win if you can, lose if you must, but always, always cheat. I believe that's the motto that they should coin.
I guess. I mean, they've gone through this so many different ways and so many different times, and I don't understand how this is just – they're so brazen with it, I guess, right? I mean, this is not subtle stuff that they get caught doing. The guy got caught red-handed in the NFL press box. Like, yeah, all right, $1 million, third-round draft pick, just keep it moving, and we'll deal with it later.
It's cost of doing business, man. Do what you got to do. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't really have it. I mean – Travis, you know the answer. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't need to tell you the answer. Look how many times they've been caught doing shady stuff.
So you believe they're cheaters and that all their championships are somewhat tainted?
Well, I mean, listen, I think everyone is trying to get an edge in that sport. Jimmy Johnson used to always have the interns rummage through the garbage after games so they could have stuff for the next time they played opponents. Like, baseball literally is about, like, that's why, like, even the Astros thing, now granted, that was that was a different level of cheating, but at the end of the day, it's still just baseball. Like, baseball literally is based on cheating. You try to steal signs. I mean, they used technology. It took it to a different level, but professional sports are about that. Like, a lot of teams are trying to cheat. Basketball's tougher. I would say, like, I don't see that. I mean, look, LeBron, there's an infamous story where LeBron, Toronto Raptors, I want to say it was Patrick Patterson was on the Toronto Raptors. I may be wrong about who it was. But long story short, and Rasheed Wallace used to do stuff like this all the time with opponents. But LeBron did it most recently where he would come out. Patrick Patterson, I guess, was new, I think, to the Raptors or whatever. And he's like, hey, Patrick, look, you got to stand here for this play because the guy's going to come on a curl here and you got to set the screen here. And, like, literally called out their entire play. And Dwayne Casey's, like, shaking his head on the sideline going, I can't believe this is happening. But, yeah, like, that stuff is just – people know what other teams are doing. It's just a matter of executing at that point, you know?
Very quickly, George, it seems like, you know, the NBA is getting ready. The NFL has been ready all along. But baseball, the people that follow baseball feel like there's no chance they get to the end of the line, that they may start, but there's no chance they'll finish. Do you agree?
Buster only says 0% chance.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I think if you're not playing in a bubble, you're just – you know, you're living in a bubble, you know what I'm saying, mentally, because you're being naive about this situation. I think every league should find a way to play in a bubble some way, somehow.
The Sedano Show is coming up next. We will see you here tomorrow morning at 6 on the morning show on 710 ESPN.